Accession number 10165, reel number 24.
Martin McLean, reel 24. You were just setting up defensive positions with a makeshift company on the canal at the outskirts of Dunkirk, if you could continue.
The second in command of the Cameron Highlanders, who was a second division unit, the major was delighted at what I'd produced in the way of men, because I instilled upon the men that they were here to stay and no withdrawal, and that they had to fight. Now, I was willing to fight. I hated the Germans for what they'd done to my pals, and I was only too willing to get cracking again and do some shooting up at them, even if I wasn't shooting up the firepower that we could hit them with to do shooting, because really speaking, we expected, after passing through Poperinge and having this told the story the Germans were coming towards Poperinge, that we would meet them at any time from now on, and they'd be coming advancing over towards Dunkirk. We start looking for food then. So Bob Bullman and I got together. I said, "Now, Bob, we've got a problem." Great friend of mine, Bob. We were Lance Corporals together. We both made Lance Sergeants together. And he were in different companies, but were great friends all of the service and all of our lives, because he was one of the few that was spared. We had a bit of conflict. I said, "Now, Bob, we've got to feed these lads. We can't just have them sitting around here. What are we going to do?" So I said, "Look, you go and get a hold of a lorry from the back here. There's lots of abandoned lorries. Go and find a lorry." I knew he could drive vehicles because he was an MT man. He was actually had been, I think, technical sergeant major of the MT stores. "Find a vehicle. Take a man with you." So off he went, and he came back. He had a Morris six-wheel army vehicle, and he waved to us. I said, "Right, now get up there, take a few of these lads, go through them lorries up there, see if we can find anything that's of any use to us, food, tins of biscuits, and things of that nature." Now, tins of biscuit were very hard-tack biscuits. They were like a 18-inch tall box, tin box, sealed against the weather, about 10 inches square across the top. Just to go back a little, as we're marching through from Poperinge down to Dunkirk, I realised we're also getting so weary and hungry that I stopped the men and I said, "Let's have a look in these trucks for food." And we unearthed a big pack of one of these tins of biscuits, which we opened up, and we all took a bunch, and all the other troops passing on the way down, they told them to help themselves, and they held quite a lot of packs of biscuits. They're hard tacked. As I mentioned before, you had to have good teeth even to break them, but you could munch them, and they became, filling. We each had a packet, and we moved off, and the troops passing were taking all these biscuits. They were all gone. Well, I sent Bob up the intention to try to find more of these biscuits and to find any sort of tea, sugar, milk, or anything, utensils to cook in, all things of nature that applying to the administration of troops. He went off, and he came back quite some time later with a little bit of food. He says, "Oh," he says, the lorries have been looted." He says, "There's nothing left in the food line." He says, "I found a few biscuits," he says, "and some cooking utensils." Well, the only answer to that was for them to kill some of the livestock in the farm and have that cooked, which I would have done. Got some turnips and potatoes and made a stew for the men. I believe we did do, and I mean, I would have done, we did do. I'm trying to cover up my misdemeanours there, because to loot or to steal or to rob was a wrong thing, but we were desperate now, so we took some of the chickens and the rabbits, slaughtered them and made stews of them with the turnip and the carrots and any other food produce that we could find lying around the farm, out the fields. They seemed to go a lot for sugar beets. Anyway, Bob come back, he says, "You never know what I saw back there." He says, "Well, quartermaster, he's out to the counts, and all his quartermaster staff." He says, "They're lying by the side of the road there." And he says, "I've passed them and spoke them." He says that the quartermaster's wearing Wellington boots, which he made us all dumb, by the way. He still had Wellingtons. He's wearing rubber Wellington boots. And he says he's out, and so is all the staff. They can't do much more walking. Along with him is the brigade major. So he says, "I told him to wait there, and if possible," I'm not sure if I was up with him at the time, but I was involved with them again later on. He told him to wait there, and he'd see Sergeant Major McLean. But the quartermaster says, never mind Sergeant Major McLean, it's Bulmer. This is Bulmer's own story. Bulmer says, Sergeant Major McLean is my boss now, sir. We've got a men in defensive position. Our job is to look after these men. And says, sir, if Sergeant Major McLean allows his truck to come back to pick you up, that's it. But my first job is report back to him with this stuff we've been looking for, and then if he lets us go, I'll come back and pick you up. Well, he told me it wasn't very far. The men were all digging, so I said, right, I'll come up with you. And up we went, and a load of these people on the truck. The brigade major was walking with riding breeches on and riding boots. The heel of one of his riding boots was missing, and he was walking on tiptoes, absolutely crippled with them. The men were shattered and torn. The quartermaster, Ossie Pearson, we called him, he was in a shattered state. So we put them on the lorry, and I dropped off again by my platoon, because they all had to pass this way, by my company. They all had to pass this way to go to Dunkirk. Now, Bob ran the quartermaster straight down to the docks at Dunkirk and straight onto a loading plank for boats, for where they were loading the wounded and the from ambulances. He got out the lorry and was helping him off the lorry, and the quartermaster said to Bob, Sergeant Bulmer, let's call him Sergeant Bulmer, come on, Bulmer, you come with us. He said, I want you back in England. Bulmer says, no, sir. He says, you don't mind me, I'm not refusing you, but I've got to go back to Sergeant Major McLean. He is in charge, he's my boss at the moment, and he says, you're going back to England, he's still got to fight. And he says, so he will want my help, because I'm second in command of the company, and that's what we're going to do. So back we went, he came back, and he told me this story long after Dunkirk. Told me long after, if I'd known, I'd went and saw the CEO about the quartermaster doing this, but again, it was all covered up. I wouldn't have gone anywhere with my complaints. Bob came back to us, and we got set in, working on the men, talking to the men, telling them what they had to do, making them have fields of fire. A field of fire is picking up targets and distances and ranges, so that you know where the range of certain places, the objects where Germans are liable to hide behind or infiltrate through, picking for likely means of covered approach where they may come along. And all this is going on as part of the habits of war, habits of inframinute war, preparing for a defensive position. We knew that we're going to get no defensive fire. Like, when you have a defensive position at this time, of this sort, you have a defensive fire plan whereby you have the artillery behind you and all sorts of machine guns, where if you send up an SOS, which is very light signals, as I explained at the Battle of Rocher, then the artillery would put a mat of fire in front of you and knock down the attacking Germans and things of that nature. We knew there was no such thing as this, so we're on our own. The next morning, or that night, I don't know, time stood still. We'd been at this all day, and the major of the Camerons sent for me. Runner come up. I went along to see him. He says, Sergeant Major, he says, we've been recalled back to the beaches at Dunkirk. The Camerons have been given an allocation on a ship. The French Marines have got to take over this defensive position. He had been passed on the information that the Marines, French Marines, were now responsible for the defence of this canal. So he said, now, as far intents and purpose, your number's included in mine. You're with the Cameron Highlanders, you're going back to England with us. So we started marching off down the beaches, and he was halted in the same place exactly as where we halted, on the sands. Everybody just boiled over from the roads and the sand dunes onto the sand, into these positions. Well, if you've ever smelled death, dead men decomposing in the heat of the sun, it's a horrible smell. Well, all this area was invaded with a smell. What had happened is many of the soldiers had been killed, and some had been buried in shallow graves, and with all the constant walking of people passing and moving the sand off them, their feet were shown, or a hand would be shown, and there'd be other dead people lying round. There'd be trenches full of dead men where a blast of a bomb had killed them, or they'd received a bomb themselves, carnage, and something was something to be seen. I don't want to harp on about, you know all about these scenes of war, but this was a scene of a completely beaten army, Mind, I'm saying again, I wasn't beaten. I was prepared to fight. And so was the Cameron Highlanders, this, and some of these DLI. But the remainder had one intent, to get off Dunkirk and get away. People were, the place was piled up with rifles and equipment. I sat my men down along by the Cameron Highlanders and were resting. And there was a soldier plodding along the beaches with his rifle on his back and his pack and a full equipment. And who should it be but Embledon, my platoon runner. He was in the mortar platoon, you have a motorcycle orderly working with the platoon commander. He was my runner, my motorcycle orderly. So I shouted him, Embledon! And he came over. This lad comes from Washington. He said, oh, thank God I found you, Sandwich. He said, I've been looking all over these beaches for you. Well, if you can imagine thousands upon thousands of soldiers on the beach, French, British, as far as the eye could see on either way. He had been sent to find us, and sure enough, he'd found us. I'd found him. So he came and sat down beside us and had a drink of water. There was nothing to eat. He said, Sarmadji, we've got to take your men, and you've got to report back to 6th Infantry Brigade Headquarters, which was the brigade headquarters that we belonged to. They'd got to know that I was with the Camerons. Somebody must have informed them, passing down the grape lane, oh, I saw Martin McLean with a platoon of men with the Cameron Highlanders, and he must have known where we were, that we're now on the beaches of Dunkirk, and that he sent the runner for me. Well, he found us. And I said, right, oh, men, I said, this is what's happening. I've got report back to 6th Infantry Brigade Headquarters. Now, this is the regular army. Any of you lads who have joined me from the other battalions, this is your chance now to get away back to England, because 6th Infantry Brigade will be pushed into action again. I'm not going to ask you men to do any more. I think you've done great. I said, I'll go and join 6th Infantry Brigade with the regulars of the DLI, or the reservists, the men belong to the 2nd DLI. Again, the nine of us, or maybe two or three more, trudged off following the runner, and we landed up at Brigade Headquarters, which in fact...
The others didn't come then?
No. Two or three did. Young National Service men did. The wanted leader that followed me. But I didn't want the Cymru's, because I thought they'd done enough. They'd been willing to volunteer to fight again. Then it was their chance to escape. I could have ordered them, but they weren't 2nd Div. They weren't 6th Brigade. I'm not being snooty in any way, but I think these people who joined me had been great in what they'd done, and all these others were going to escape, and it was their chance to get out as well. I was now involved back with the 2nd Division, the regular battalion, so took these men back. And it wasn't really 2nd Div headquarters. It wasn't 6th Infantry Brigade headquarters. It was the remnants of the B echelon, the quartermaster's trucks and all this. The trucks that wouldn't feed us previously, the lorries when asked to supply us with tea after the Battle of Lobesh, where we crossed the canal and wouldn't feed us, all warped up and tied up, and the Dixies were gone. We got a cup of tea and something to eat, fortunately. I mean, we're ready for it. It wasn't much, but it was a stew of some sort and a pot of tea, which was like beautiful stuff. It's like drinking nectar, the honey, as they talk about. I've never tasted the damn stuff, but it was beautiful to taste nice, sweet tea again. And then I was sent for, the man in charge of this group was the quartermaster of the Royal Berkshire Regiment, who had been RSM with us in Normain, and he'd been promoted up the line when their quartermaster either left or was promoted or whatever it was. He took over quartermaster. He said, right, Sarmadji. He says, I've been told to find a platoon of men from the 6th Infantry Brigade to go on the last line of bridges. He says, it's a last man, last round stand. And he says, I'm sorry to say, now that we've found you, you're the man that's got to do it. They had no infantry officers. There was no infantry officers there. All that I had there was CQMSs, sergeants, cooks, and all this nature of people, cobblers and other things that make up the battalion headquarters. And he said, I want you to take a section of an NCO and 12 men to go on this bridge. Now, I'll give you the same from the Royal Welsh Fusiliers and the Royal Berks. He says, I have them already. He says, but you're platoon commander. He says, now, come with me. He says, first of all, get your men. So I fell all of B echelon in, and I said to the CQMSs, I said, now, I've been asked to find volunteers to go on this bridge. I said, I prefer volunteers. And that means UCQMSs as well, who've never fired a shot yet. These lads have played out with shooting and firing and killing, and they've escaped a lot. Now, I want willing volunteers to come with me on this fight to go and take up this position on the last line of bridges. And they're all stupefied at this request, including the sergeants and the men who had been in this panic of driving to get away. Well, now, they must have been in Dunkirk some time because they got past all this blockage of lorries with their vehicles and are now on the beaches at Dunkirk with all their B echelon vehicles. They looked at me in amazement. But just at that moment, the quartermaster of the Royal Box says, "Sergeant Major, I want you with me a minute." So I said, "Don't go away at the men." I went off with the officer, and he says, "This is the lorry I've designated for you. In there you'll find some food, because we are going out with today. They'll find some food and some blankets and stuff you might want, and some ammunition." So I looked at again, it was another modest six-wheeler truck. It was Blanc, the Royal Engineers, incidentally. It wasn't an infantry one, but it was theirs, and it was piled up at the back with a lot of stuff. So I said, "Right, officer," and he says, "No, you've got to get off soon." He says, "A guide is here. He'll take your lady off to the men." So when I went back, lo and behold, this is something I never lived down, nor did I ever forgive the men who done it. All the CQMSs had vanished. All the sergeants had vanished. Cowards, if ever there was any. They decided they weren't going over. They all found excuses to leave, settle away from this thing, having jobs to do, maybe cooking or something like that. So I berated all the men that was there. I sent for whoever I could find in the area, and I berated them no end at all. Mind, they all suffered from me in one way or other when they did get back to England. I had no time at all for them. I had no time at all for a lot of sound majors too. I was venomous in my attitude to them from there on. And it right throughout my service, if any of them crossed my path, he was in trouble. I roped them all in again and laced them. And I said, "I'll take back my same men that I had with us, who's been through so much." I said, "You buggers, you're not what they like. You're cowards." They didn't like it, but they could please themselves. They were. Haven't gone away like that. They'll come back if anyone hears this with recriminations. I don't care. They're prepared to face me. I'll tell them the same to their faces. And I know some of them by name. I led the men off with the Royal Burks and the Daylight taken up each side of the road again. And we marched along the roads. And there we were going back the same route as I'd been with the Cameron Islanders. We reached the first steel bridge, which is one of the two main bridges over the canal leading into Dunkirk. Now, you've got to imagine this road. It was the bridge was directly opposite the road where all the troops that was coming from Popper Inge, which is now about the only way out, was coming down from Popper Inge and making for the beach. French, British, beaten soldiers, all sorts of condition they were, coming across this bridge and going down the sands. That was the bridge I had to defend. That was the bridge I had to work on with these men to make it into a defence position in case of any attack by the Germans. So I had a look around at the bridge and decided to build the men, have the men dig with tools, whatever tools we could get. There were some shovels and picks on this lorry, by the way, into the banks of the canal so that the men would have some head cover and protection for to shoot on a level, which is very level ground, across the canals at any approaching enemy. I set the platoons off in different areas, the Welsh, the Burks, not platoons, sections, I will keep saying. The only section of 12 Burks, 12 Royal Welsh, I should say Royal Burks, each commanded by a sergeant and NCOs. With me, I had Sergeant Bulmer, Lance Corporal Fallon, and other men of the Durham Light Infantry. And I put our men in the centre, around the edges of the bridge. Now, just behind us on the bridge was a 25-pounder gun, an artillery piece, mounted on a travis. A travis is a thing that's put under the wheels so that you can turn the gun round like an anti-tank gun, so it runs on an even keel for aiming a gun. I looked around for gunners. The gun was loaded. No gunners. No nothing. Just a gun loaded and left there. Now, Bob Bulmer and I disputed about this. He said there was no gun. I said there was. I said, because I planned how to fire it. I said, we had been shown how to worked it good in the States, you know, in part, well, filling time training. As a matter of fact, I was going to fire it by lanyards by putting a rope onto the firing pin, because it was right out in the open, this gun. If anyone's attacking, they're going to hit you. I'd only had the one round in. I was just going to aim it up the road and then have it fired with this lanyard to hit any tanks coming along. You could fix them onto a fixed line, you know, so it'd fire on that one spot. The men were all digging in. Now, a Brigadier Lawson, who was the CRA, Command Royal Artillery, came across and he saw who I was, made himself known. He says, "I'm in charge of the defence of Dunkirk." He says, "You have a special job here now." He says, "You've got to hold this bridge, last man, last round." He says, "I see you're already digging in defence and you've got your men well equipped." Well, I was stopping them, taking more brands up, because although my men were well equipped, the others weren't. We're equipping the men up once again with the brands and the rifles and ammunition and grenades.
This is off passing troops?
On passing troops, yes. And then he said, "I want you to stop all British troops and send them down this road to Dunkirk, and all French troops have got to go across that other bridge further along. And by the way, that bridge is held by the Cameron Highlanders," he told me. He says, "So if you want liaise with them, you'll go along and meet them and liaise. But all French troops, by order of the organisation, so as we can segregate troops, British troops this way, French that way. French to cross over that bridge."
This is a different unit of the Cameron Highlanders.
Same unit. Same. Actually, one of them was the same men. I'll talk about them in a minute. So I had to put sentries on the bridge now and direct the French over the other bridge. And they used to stand and argue and be voluble with their arms waving, blah, blah, blah. They thought we were letting them down, you know, that we were finished fighting with them and this, that and the other. And that they didn't want to go across the other bridge, want to come this one, because they could see the sea, they could smell see the sand. And it was meant another bit of march across that way. Anyway, I insisted upon this. Now, I was standing at the bridge once when a whole column of French troops came past, led by an officer of the Frenchmen. And the halt of the men who were going to go across the bridge, I said, "No, nix." I couldn't speak French. I said, "Nix." And they stopped. He halted these men. And he started saying that they were going to cross the bridge. I said, "No." I said, "Orders." In my broken French, "French troops that way over that bridge. British troops this way to be formed up in groups so that they're all together." This officer became very voluble. He was going to go across the bridge. As a matter of fact, I talk about these things and people sort of say, "He's a bloody idiot, this man," when you tell the story. He pulled his ruddy pistol out to us. And he started waving it. Well, when he saw my lads once again on the bridge and their rifles down the on yard, maybe he had a second thought. Now, God be my judge on this. Again, I tell the truth. On the television, about 5 years ago, there was a story of the evacuation of Dunkirk. And they were bringing back survivors of people who were actually took part in the survival of Dunkirk. But funny enough, nobody ever asked me, and I was involved with it a lot. And there was that French officer talking on television. And he says, "A British sergeant major stopped me and wouldn't let me cross the bridge with my men." He said, "I pulled my pistol out and threatened him." He says, "We showed him who was going to get across the bridge. We took our men across the bridge." He was telling lies. Then people didn't get across the bridge. They went across the other one, moaning and groaning. But he was on television, the same officer. You see how you get an impression of a person once you've had an argument with you. You know him. That was him. By this time, the bridge was wide open. So I sent Bob Bulmer, once again, very handy man, off to go and find some transport to block the bridge up with and to make it into a one line of infantry passing over only, so no vehicles could come over, because again we're thinking of tanks. And Bob found a great big workshop lorry. The workshop lorry was about an 8-wheeler lorry, I don't know the size of it, a big heavy Thornycroft, and in the back of it was turning lathes, drilling machines, all sorts of stuff for repairs of whatever it is they have to repair, but it was like a small workshop on wheels. and Bob pulled it at an angle across the bridge, jamming the front wheels against one side of the bridge and leaving just enough gap on the other side for people infantry to walk through. And it was at an angle so that anybody come up from the rear was to bump it, to knock it in, they'd only jam it further onto the bridge. We tried to wreck this lorry, but it was hopeless. It was so heavily made and strong, we bashed the engine up and we left it at that. So we had now a roadblock across the bridge. And then Brigadier Lawson came up later on with a French... this could be... A night could have elapsed or whatever, I don't know, but it was just one continuous now, on guard, digging in, preparing for defence. My main concern was on the bridge. I'd been along to see the Cameron Highlanders who were on the right, and lucky blokes, the Camerons, they had in their headquarters where they were sitting, a huge warehouse full of British Army food, fruits, tin fruit, rum jars full of rum and all sorts. Well, I knew my men wanted feeding, so Bob Bulmer was with us, driving us in a lorry. I said, Bob, get that lorry loaded up with food, what you can, and take it along. We'll feed the men that's passing, and we'll also feed ourselves. We took four big clear hens of rum, big jug bottles of rum, and I stood by the side of the road when I got back to my bridge, and it was the Cameron Hand, as I mentioned. The sergeant I knew, he'd been with the platoon, the company of the Camerons, where we helped out on the canal. We could take the lot for him. They were having a merry time, but I wouldn't let my men drink much because I didn't want them to get drunk. And in their weak state or tired state, they could easily get drunk, but I gave them all a liberal ration of rum. I took the rest on the bridge, and Bob Bulmer and me took it in turns for to feed the lads who were passing with a tot of rum. And it was the real strong army rum. One tablespoonful was enough to really make you feel it. It had a good drink. Well, passing over there on one of these occasions was one of our old regular officers, Major MacBain. He was working with brigade. He had his riding breeches on and his riding boots, and he was exhausted completely. So I stopped him. I gave him a tot of rum. I spoke to him. I said, sir, well, when you go back to England, you might just pass the word if we don't get back that the Durhams were on this last line of bridges on Dunkirk. I have a good section of men, willing fighters, and I've also got a section of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers and a section of Berks. And my orders, my job, is to hold this bridge against everything that comes this way till the last man dies, till the last round. And as far as I'm concerned, it will be done. He says, a good show. I thought he might have volunteered to stop us, but no, he passed on. This is what was happening all the way along. Nobody wanted to stop now. Everybody had defeated. They were going back, and that was it. So,
were any preparations made to blow up the bridge?
I'll tell you just about that. I'll just leave
now. Okay, sorry.
If you don't mind.
No.
Major Lawson, Brigadier Lawson, came up to me with an officer in tow, a little French officer, a bearded man, a very tired man, dishevelled like all of the rest of us. He was a general of the French army, and he was told that I was in charge of the bridge and that I was responsible for all of its defence. And he told me that the French were taking over the defence of the whole of the area of Dunkirk, but that I would be included in the network of the defensive positions, and that I had to hold this bridge no matter what happens. But I had not to blow the bridge up. Now, they call this General Falgard. And, by now, we British lads were taking very little notice of the French, because I've explained before, a lot of them didn't want to fight, a lot of them had no intention of fighting. But this man appeared a fiery little general. But he told me, he said, I want you to go under that bridge. He says, you've told me that it's mine. Yes, it was mine. Big slabs of amnol laid the full width and length of the bridge underneath. And he said, I want you to try to dismantle the explosives. In other words, take the igniter sets and the little round slab of gun cotton that he used to put inside of a hole in the big amnol whereby the wires or the electricity charge would feed this little round thing. The igniter set would explode, set this other smaller round thing off with ignition, and then explode the whole case of Aminol. Now, there's an igniter set outside on the bridge, which had been left abandoned, by the way. Again, no one there. Just a plunger, an igniter set with its wires off. Stand beside the set roadside. In other words, you harness the two wires up, you press it, and you blow it. Blow the bridge. Now, he said he didn't want this bridge blown under any circumstance whatever, and that it had to be defended, and that...